This is a Suno India production, and you are listening to Every Indian's Checklist.
This podcast has adult content. It may also be triggering for some. Please use discretion before listening to it.
It's not about what do I do. It's about how do you feel? How do you feel at that point of time? If it's not correct, obviously it's not good. It's not right. Just walk to the police station. You know what are your rights. You have all right to file the cases. You have all right to lodge the complaint.
What do you feel when you hear men hooting at you as sexy while you're waiting for a bus? In all probability, while you're hiding your face, you're desperately hoping that they don't approach you or worse, touch you. You may often feel immobilized or numb at that point. But as lawyer Sana Wahab, who you heard earlier, said, if it feels wrong, we have a right to speak about it. Finding a safe space and giving words to that feeling helps women know what they want to do with it, either file a police complaint or just vent it out to a friend. Last month in September, four upper caste men allegedly raped a 19-year-old woman in Hathras district in Uttar Pradesh. Later, she succumbed to her injuries in a Delhi hospital. It took her 5 days to file a first information report or FIR with the police. We at Suno India want to inform women about their rights, the various laws and legal procedures around sexual assault and rape. Hi, I'm Vaishali, a reporter for Suno India and your host for this episode of the Suno India Show's Every Indian Checklist. I spoke to Abhimanyu Tiwari, a Delhi-based lawyer who practices in the Supreme Court, and Sana Wahab, an advocate based in Hyderabad, to understand the various laws and procedures related to sexual crimes against women. Before we go further, what do the terms sexual assault, abuse, harassment and rape mean under the law? Let's understand them one by one. Don't worry about the numbers of the sections. It's more important to understand what the law is about. First, sexual harassment, stalking and voyeurism are defined under Section 354 of the Indian Penal Code or the IPC. If someone touches a woman or is making explicitly sexual overtures, when the woman is making it clear that she does not welcome it or want it, it's sexual harassment. Inappropriate jokes, WhatsApp forwards, personal remarks, commenting on a woman's body and verbal abuse all come under sexual harassment.
Sexual harassment, you know, it includes physical contact and a demand of request for sexual favors, showing pornography, making sexual colored or remarks. And later, it too goes to voyeurism. Voyeurism basically, like in law, basically how we define voyeurism is like as a man watching or capturing the image of a woman engaged in a private act. Like if she is changing her clothes or something, whatever she is doing privately, if some man catches it or captures it in the mobile or camera, and later he uses it for blackmailing her, it all comes under voyeurism. It's a part of sexual harassment. It can be regressed, like the punishment, it starts from 1 year and it can goes up to 3 years, 3 years or 7 years also. Later, when it comes to stalking, which comes under Section 354D of IPC, it includes continuous following or contacting a woman by a man or attempts to contact a woman to build a personal relationship.
One of the landmark criminal cases in sexual harassment was the Rupan Deol Bajaj case. In 1988, Rupan Bajaj, an IAS officer, was serving as a special secretary in finance department in Punjab. Tiwari spoke about this case.
So the Rupan Deol Bajaj case was one of the first cases which dealt with sexual misconduct. It was not rape. The idea of the case was that Mr. KPS Gill, who was a noted police officer at that time, had been accused of slapping the backside of Mrs. Bajaj, who was also an administrative service employee at the moment. She was an IAS officer. What is important in the case, though, is not the facts of the case, but rather the journey of the case through the Indian legal system, because I think that is very symptomatic of the problems that we face. The case, even though the complainant in the case was what we would call a powerful person, in the sense she was herself a senior IAS officer, entrenched in the power corridors of the nation, it took her the better part of a decade to see any real justice. The case was initially thrown out as being inconsequential by our courts.
Bajaj had to move the Supreme Court to even start the trial. Finally, Gill was convicted to imprisonment for 3 months and a fine of 2 lakh rupees. The fine was donated to a women's rights organization as Bajaj refused to accept it. On Gill's appeals to the higher court, the punishment was converted into a probation. Gill did not spend a day in jail. In 1988, the laws related to sexual harassment were not sufficient to cover the experiences of women. It was only in 2013 that the Parliament passed the Criminal Law Amendment Act that expanded the definitions and added sections related to stalking, voyeurism, forcible disrobing of women, acid attacks and trafficking. Though marital rape is not recognized, the law does penalize husbands who force sexual relations on their wives when they separated. The amendment came after the gruesome rape and murder of Delhi-based physiotherapist Jyoti Singh, called Nirbhaya by the media then. A committee was set up under the chairmanship of retired Justices J.S. Verma, Leela Seth and Senior Counsel Gopal Subramaniam. This committee suggested many changes in the laws related to sexual assault and harassment.
So the biggest aspect of the 2013 Nirbhaya amendment was to radically change the concept of rape as it existed in India. Prior to this, rape had very narrow connotations and was said to have been constituted only if there was a penal insertion into a vagina. However, after the said amendment, the definition of rape underwent a radical change. From a very limited connotation of penal insertion, rape became the insertion of any instrument, any other organ. It expanded to become a more real-world definition. Oral sex or anal sex without consent, the insertion of inanimate objects into private parts or any other orifice came under the definition of rape. It also went forward to define the term gang rape itself and increased the penal consequences of that to 20 years, which is something that did not exist earlier.
In case of rape and other sexual offenses, a woman can file a complaint in any police station.
Zero FIR, it's a provision for the woman, like if something has happened to you, like the sexual assault or 498, you can go to any police station wherever you are residing. Okay, it's not like jurisdiction ki aapke sath ye jo harkat hui thi sexual assault ki hai ya aapke in-laws aapke against kuch kiye hai to aapko wahin par jaakar case file karna. It's not like that. Wherever you are residing, jurisdiction aata hai ya nahi aata, that doesn't matter. But jo area PS aapka hai, they have to take your complaint, they have to file the complaint, and later they have to transfer it to the PS where the jurisdiction comes. So it's the headache of the police station people. It's not the headache of you. It's a provision for you that you can go to the area PS also, anywhere, wherever you are residing.
Remember, you can file a complaint at any police station at any time. No matter how long it has been since you've been sexually assaulted, molested or raped, you can file a complaint. Police can't refuse to register an FIR at any time, saying you didn't report it earlier.
इसमें भी एक प्रोविजन वुमेन्स के लिए जो है कि थोड़े लेडीज क्या करते हैं, वो लोग डर जाते हैं जब ये चीज होती है, दे डोंट कम आउट इमीडिएटली. सो देयर इज अ प्रोविजन ऑफ वुमेन, वेदर इट्स 3 इयर्स, 4 इयर्स, चाहे वो कितने भी साल हो, दे कैन कम आउट आफ्टर दैट ऑल्सो कि भाई नहीं, अब मेरे साथ वो हुआ था, आई वॉन्ट टू टेक द स्टेप नाउ, सो आई वॉन्ट टू ओपन माई माउथ नाउ, आई डोंट वॉन्ट टू, you know, like leave that person. If they don't want to do that, yes, law is always with them, law is always supportive to them.
The Criminal Law Amendment also looked at laws relating to procedure and attempted to ease it for women. If a woman does decide to go to the police station, her statement should be recorded by a woman police officer.
I think it is important to be coherent, to be forceful at the police station, ensure that the complaint is actually registered. The police over the years have created a big ruckus over registering a report. So taking something down in written paper, giving what is known as a diary number to it, is not the registration of an FIR. Again, after the recent amendments, there are provisions which makes it illegal for a cop not to register a report itself. That's an offense qua the police officer himself.
But in case cops don't follow the law and refuse to file FIR, case can be made out against them under Section 166A of the IPC, under which the cops can face punishment of up to 2 years in jail. In fact, this rule applies even to doctors who refuse to treat a sexual assault victim. But these provisions are rarely used. Tiwari suggests that if police refuse to file a complaint, the victim should send her complaint to the local superintendent of police with a copy to Inspector General of Police via registered post. The law also makes provisions for sexual assault victims who are temporarily or permanently mentally or physically disabled. For example, in the Hathras case, where the victim woman's spine was injured badly, or for instance, a woman having panic attacks, in such cases, the police have to go to the victim's residence or any other convenient location. The police can also take assistance of an interpreter or social educator. The interview of such victims should also be videographed. As per the law, the identity of the woman complainant has to be protected. Leaking the information is punishable under Section 228A of the IPC. If one reveals the name of the victim, either verbally or by publishing it in a newspaper for instance, they'll face punishment of 2 years in jail. While these laws exist on paper, it is important to note that these are not necessarily implemented.
There is a massive amount of opaqueness in the system about how many people are sort of falling through the cracks. There are different socio-economic realities to different class stratas. So the idea of a woman who has faced an assault, and if she belongs to a lower strata of our society, lower caste strata or class strata, the realities for them would be fundamentally different from those who are belonging to the higher caste or class strata.
Having said this, knowing about the law and rights will help in demanding for it. Let's try understand how the law sets into motion once a criminal complaint of sexual harassment or sexual assault or rape is filed before the police.
So once the FIR is filed, again, the recent amendments ensure that her statement is to be taken before a magistrate as soon as possible. In most cases, within 24 hours, that's the 164 CRPC. Now, these are statements which are admissible per se before the court when the stage of evidence comes in the sense that their evidentiary value is much higher. There are also statements under 161. These are supposed to be given to the investigating officer. Now, the evidentiary statement of these are low. A statement made under 164, because it's made before a magistrate, has higher evidentiary value because you are supposed to be fearless in front of a magistrate. A magistrate is supposed to be an impartial person, not connected to the police infrastructure or insulated from the political infrastructure. And you are supposed to be able to express your mind and with a degree of fearlessness without any coercion. With 161, there is a probability which is attached to the scenario in which the statement is being taken. The courts over the years have come to the realization that the probability in certain cases of coercion before a police officer is high. And the statement recorded before a police officer, although it might be absolutely similar to a statement recorded before a magistrate, will carry less evidentiary values.
The woman complainant can demand that her 164 statement can be taken to have a better chance in court. Ideally, the police should help the woman go to the government hospital and get a checkup soon after the cases of sexual assault. When medical evidence is taken, the complainant's consent needs to be taken.
Despite there being a robust law, the investigative agency is not taking the individual for medical checkups, is that private medical checkups are also not prohibited. This idea that a checkup which is done only through the government agencies is the only one which will carry evidentiary value is wrong. An individual who gets her checkup done or his checkup done privately will also have a fair amount of medical corroborative strength in his evidence. Medical checkup done through proper channels in a government hospital or done on the insistence of the investigative agency will have a higher evidentiary value. But that does not mean that a private one is useless or it will not carry any evidentiary value. It's better than nothing.
While conducting a medico-legal examination, government doctors often conduct what is called the two-finger test or the virginity test. In 2013, the Ministry of Health and Family Welfare issued guidelines for medico-legal examination of sexual assault victims, which clearly said that this test should not be conducted. The reason why doctors do this test is because it is assumed that if a doctor is able to insert two fingers in the vagina, the woman is used to having sex. If not, the girl is assumed to be a virgin. This fact, however, has no bearing to prove rape. So this test is blatantly unscientific and violates a woman's dignity and integrity. The police are expected to finish the investigation in 2 months for crimes against women. At most, under regular criminal law, they have to finish the investigation in 90 days and submit what is called the charge sheet. During this time, the police look for witnesses, if any, who can help corroborate the woman's story. In case of a case of sexual harassment using electronic media, it makes sense to keep records of phone calls or messages or Facebook posts or WhatsApp messages, for instance.
Our law per se is very clear and very female-centric in this, that in most of these cases, a conviction can be obtained only on the testimony of the person. I'll give you a very short example. Let's say a person says that in a room alone where there was no CCTV, a male employee sexually harassed or touched a female employee inappropriately. Now, outside, the law recognizes that outside of her own testimony, there is no other way of proving it. It's always a he said, she said. And up until you can really jar the testimony of the victim by, for example, saying that the date which he has mentioned in a complaint is a date in which the two people were in separate countries, you know, unless it's very apparent that this is a false case, the mere testimony of the person is enough for a conviction. And that must be recognized, that you shouldn't, people shouldn't be afraid of coming forth only because they feel that there is no documentary evidence or there is no videographical evidence. You have to recognize that in most cases, the testimony of the person or the victim is enough to secure a conviction.
The charge sheet is a document which contains FIR, witness statements, and important documents such as phone records. The witnesses include those who heard about the crime from the victim immediately after the assault, people present during collection of physical evidence from the site of crime, forensic doctors, and investigating officers. Once the charge sheet is submitted before the court, the stages of trial begin. Let's get to what is expected in the trial.
So with regards to the criminal trial, the first reality of the trial which everyone must acknowledge, and it's an unfortunate reality, is that it takes a fair amount of time and it is something which causes a great deal of harassment and anxiety even to the complainant. It should not. This, I think, is one of the greatest failings of our criminal system. But the reality is that it does. As of today, it does.
Tiwari explains the role of a woman complainant in a trial.
What people don't realize is that in a trial, the individual victim has the rights of a witness, maybe a special kind of witness, but you're actually a third party to the trial. The two main parties to trial are the state, which is the prosecution, and the accused. So as a victim or the complainant, you are inherently a third party to the process, a very important third party, but a third party nonetheless. Now, the two main lawyers in the courtroom will be obviously of the two main parties, which is the prosecution or the state, who is the PP, and the defense counsel. So being a third party, I think it's always better for you or for an individual to have legal assistance. A complainant's counsel can assist the public prosecutor. Now, what that means is not something that has been defined very clearly. In real terms, what happens is that public prosecutors, like all other government officers, are very heavily overworked. It comes to the complainant's counsel to prepare the case, mark all the relevant documents, and in essence, spoon feed the public prosecutor. So the role of the complainant's counsel is very important in that regard.
If a woman does not have resources to get an advocate, often non-profit organizations working on women's rights help such women out. The new amendments in criminal law have provisions to protect women in trials.
the primary protection is what is known as the in-camera trial. And the idea is that when a victim of a sexual assault is being cross-examined or is giving her examination in chief, she has to be made comfortable due to the particulars of our social demograph and our social traditions, if you would want to call them, or our social baggage. There is a degree of anonymity which is provided for. The victim is not subject to a full courtroom. The victim is supposed to be made comfortable by the presiding officer or the judge. There are also guidelines with regards to what can be asked of a victim. There are guidelines which say that you can't question the moral characteristics of the act or go after the moral characteristics or background of the individual victim. You can't malign the victim. You can't browbeat the victim.
One needs to remember that the evidence recorded during the trial makes or breaks the case. Even if the woman complainant feels that she needs to challenge the acquittal of the accused in the higher courts, she has to rely on the same evidence that is recorded in the trial court.
Very rarely will an appellate court go in for further evidence or new evidence to be produced. Our mechanisms for that, though they do exist, are limited. So if a prosecution or if the initial trial is not done properly, if the evidence has not been taken properly, then in most cases, that defect will provide to be fatal for the case of the prosecution.
All the laws and guidelines related to sexual crimes against women are meant to ease the experience of the complaining woman. But these are not all necessarily implemented. Having said that, it's important for all of us to know what are the rights on the paper. This will give us ammunition to effectively demand for our rights. Thank you for listening to Every Indian's Checklist. You can listen to this podcast in our website sunoindia.in and any other podcast app of your choice.